Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, the Rim Fire continues to devastate the mountain areas west of Yosemite National Park. We'll get an update on the fire and talk with one resident who is staying put at his home just miles from the fire line. In politics, Jerry Brown is set to become the longest-serving governor in California history this fall. We'll look back at his evolution from 1974 to the present day. In local news, we'll talk with animal control officials from Kern County and learn how they're scrambling to find a new home for some 700 animals by October 1st after being evicted from the city of Bakersfield's animal shelter. That and the amazing story of the late Bea Franco, who died last week. She was the Selma woman who inspired a character in Jack Kerouac's book On the Road. That's all coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. A bill that would allow some non-physician healthcare professionals in California to perform first trimester abortions has cleared the Senate. Max Pringle reports from Sacramento.
Democratic Senator Hannah Beth Jackson says women who lack adequate access to trained abortion providers face greater health risks.
It becomes more and more problematic the longer it is delayed, and it is frequently delayed because women do not have access. They have to drive long distances.
But Republican Senator Jim Nielsen says when complications arise, nursing assistants, physician assistants, and midwives lack a doctor's life-saving skills and experience.
That's when the maximum training and expertise and access to the hospital privileges that doctors have that this class would not come to bear.
Trained non-physician healthcare professionals perform thousands of abortions with a complication rate of less than 2% during a recently completed UC San Francisco pilot study. Max Pringle, Capital Public Radio News.
The California legislature will vote on a plan that would ease prison overcrowding before the legislative session ends in September. That's the message from Democratic Assembly Speaker John Perez. The state has been ordered to reduce overcrowding in multiple federal court rulings. But Perez says people shouldn't worry about 10,000 inmates suddenly being released.
We're going to look at every housing opportunity that we have, consistent with the requirements of the courts, but we will not release a single additional prisoner.
Finding more space for inmates will be expensive, and Perez says the money will likely come from the state's reserve and could cut into other programs California would like to fund. State leaders have long maintained California has done enough to reduce overcrowding. The courts have consistently disagreed and at one point threatened to hold Governor Jerry Brown in contempt if he didn't cooperate with rulings ordering him to reduce the prison population. Newly elected State Senator Andy Vidak is calling for California voters to have another say on the future of the state's high-speed rail project. The Hanford Republican is offering an amendment to a transportation bill that would require a new vote, saying that much has changed since Proposition 1A was approved in 2008. Earlier this month, a Sacramento judge ruled that the Rail Authority's funding plan doesn't comply with voter-approved law by failing to identify funding for the entire first segment of the line and by not obtaining all environmental approvals before moving forward with construction. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. The Rim Fire is now being called the sixth largest wildfire in California history, growing to nearly 180,000 acres overnight. Over 3,700 firefighters are battling the blaze, which is now 20% contained. There's no containment date, however. Late yesterday, officials expanded the evacuation area as the fire continues to spread to the east and southeast. Residents in an area from Miwok to Pinecrest are now being advised to leave their homes by Tuolumne County Sheriff's deputies. The scope of the fire is simply immense. Yesterday, a NASA astronaut aboard the International Space Station captured the massive smoke plume over Central California as seen from space with a photo shared on Twitter.
To tell us more about the Rim Fire and the impact on the local communities in Tuolumne and Mariposa County, we thought we'd talk with a local resident. Joining us now on the telephone is Bob Mosier. He is a resident of the small Mariposa County community of Greeley Hill, which is just north of Coulterville and just miles from the fire lines. Bob, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you.
You're still in your home, which is close to the fire lines. Where are you in relationship to the Rim Fire and the area that is burned?
Well, it goes around us quite a ways. If I look out my front door to the east, it's just a little bit northeast, and then if I go around towards the north, it'll go right to the northwest. So it's about a quarter of the way around us. We can actually see the fire if we look towards the east. We can see it. It's about 4 miles from the house now, and we can also see it about 6 miles away on this side of Pilot Ridge.
What's the response been like from firefighters in your area in terms of protecting the residents and the property in your general vicinity?
To the north, it's they've got that part of it pretty well contained, I think, and you know, they protected the areas of Pine Mountain Lake and Groveland, and they seem to have protected the community of Buck Meadows. And they stopped it on the north side of Highway 120 in those areas. So now the wind seems to be always blowing in that direction towards Tuolumne City and Twain Hart and some of those places.
And away from, fortunate for you, your community. Have you ever seen anything like this before in this area?
Yeah, we have had some fires up here before that were even a little bit closer and had the potential of coming towards the community a little bit more. And then, of course, there was a fire about 20 years ago that swept through the whole thing and completely burned, I think, believe all the way to Sonora that time.
When it comes to evacuations, there are a number of communities that are under evacuation advisories and people have left their homes. What's the situation like in your neighborhood around 4 miles from the fire line? Have some of your neighbors left?
Yeah, I know that some of them have left. Some of them, I'm sure that in the mornings it's very smoky here and that causes some problems for them. And there are other people who just want to get away and kind of get a head start just in case something goes wrong. But I think for the most part, you know, when you live up here, you know that this is something that can happen every year, and you just prepare for it. You make a list of what you want to take, and, you know, when we were here before during the telegraph fire, we were on a 15-minute evacuation for about 6 days, which meant that any time they could come back and tell you you've got 15 minutes to leave. And this time, I think the advisor that they have is just letting them know that they could be getting another evacuation notice soon, and just to be prepared, you know.
Have you and your wife taken steps to maybe pack up a few valuables ahead of time, or is that still something far away?
Yeah, she's been packing some things up. I had most of my valuables in the truck. You know, I've got my ATV and my mountain bike, and we were on a camping trip up in the El Dorado National Forest when we found out about this after about 5 days after it started. So we came back home. So a lot of my toys were already packed up. And she has a list of the different things, the papers and the pictures and different things that she wants to take. You know, the jewelry, any kind of valuable things that she didn't want to lose. And, yeah, we've got it kind of sitting out in the living room all there now, the file cabinets and things. And we've also got the trailer hooked up and the toys, my toys and things already in there. So I think there are several people do that. And, of course, the people with the animals, with horses and sheep and things, seem to always be prepared to have some way to get them out. So I think, as a whole, people are pretty prepared. We were just in town about an hour ago, and I see the Red Cross shelter is set up again in our community hall, because there are some people who have been evacuated for sure out in the more of the rural areas.
What's the mood like in the community right now?
You know, I think everybody's just, they call each other once in a while and ask them what they can see and how they're doing, and I think people are feeling pretty safe, but also cautious, you know.
There's been such a concern this year with the dry, extremely dry conditions throughout the mountains and foothills. This has been a concern by a lot of people this year that we would have one of these massive, massive fires. Has this been something that people have been worried about in your neck of the woods?
Well, I think they do worry a little bit more when it's dry. And, you know, we get a lot of information from CAL FIRE and different places on how to make your home defendable. You know, if you have a pretty good defendable space around your home and they can send a crew in there, they can do a pretty good job of protecting it. And I think that's more of the thing that people are concerned about, is how to make their homes defendable.
And you've taken those precautions?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, I'm so sure that we're not going to get a fire up here. I had some weeds outside that I've been needed to take care of. I had to go spray Roundup on them again because I know they're not going to burn. So we feel pretty good here.
We've been talking with Bob Mosier. He's a resident of the small Mariposa County community of Greeley Hill. It's just north of Coulterville, and he's a few miles from the front lines of the Rim Fire, which is currently burning in Tuolumne and Mariposa counties and in Yosemite National Park. Bob, thank you so much for joining us, and please be safe.
Okay, thank you.
This is Valley Edition. California lawmakers are voting on hundreds of bills in the final weeks of the legislative session. And the man who will determine their fate is approaching a milestone. In less than 2 months, Jerry Brown will become the longest-serving governor in California history. Ben Adler has more from Sacramento on how the Brown of today compares to the Brown of 30 years ago.
The year was 1974. Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles topped the movie charts. Watergate finally felled Richard Nixon, and 36-year-old Jerry Brown won his first term as governor.
Here comes this young guy whose father had been governor, who was campaigning on how money and influence had usurped the process.
Former Democratic lawmaker Rusty Arias is a longtime friend of the governor's, who's now a Sacramento lobbyist.
And there was a lot of resentment toward Jerry because of his age, because what they viewed as a lack of preparedness.
Many Californians loved Pat Brown, and lawmakers pushing for infrastructure spending expected Jerry to reverse the conservative fiscal policies of predecessor Ronald Reagan. But Brown surprised a lot of people by campaigning on political reform and taking a small is beautiful approach to government. He was considered enigmatic. Here's an ABC News report from 1975.
Brown's father was governor of California, but not many know what kind of governor his son is going to turn out to be.
What kind of a person I am, what kind of a person are you? Knowing yourself is a task for a life. And I am trying to call people's attention to the realities and wake them up before it's too late. And if that's an enigma, so be it.
Brown had a number of victories. He signed legislation that allowed collective bargaining for public employees. He enforced Proposition 13 after voters approved it over his objections. And he appointed women and minorities to high-profile positions. But lawmakers overrode gubernatorial vetoes 3 times, something they rarely did before and haven't done since. And Brown spent much of his time running for president, twice. Fast forward to 2011. Jerry Brown was sworn back into the governor's office at age 72.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation.
Without any mental reservation.
Or?
Really, no mental reservations.
And he's gotten most of what he's asked for this time. Frugal budgets from legislative Democrats and tax hikes from voters, not to mention overhauls of the state's pension and school funding systems. California may still have hundreds of billions of dollars of long-term debt, but the state's $27 billion budget deficit is gone, at least for now. Longtime Republican strategist Marty Wilson worked to defeat Brown in 1978. He's now with the California Chamber of Commerce.
Well, it seems like he's developed quite a stack of accomplishments, a resume of accomplishments, here in his first couple of years.
And former Democratic Senate leader David Roberti suggests there are 3 main reasons why.
Number one, he's not running for any national office. Number two, Jerry was not quite the pragmatist then that he is now. And he hadn't any experience in local government then that he has now.
Brown spent 8 years as mayor of Oakland in between his two stints as governor. Former Republican lawmaker Bill Leonard says that gave him a new perspective.
It seemed to me he learned a lot about how the executive branch gets things done or not, that he hadn't really learned as governor the first time, and he had to really confront problems at literally the street level that governors don't necessarily see.
Well, yeah, I do see government differently.
Brown tells Capital Public Radio his 40 years of experience help him separate the wheat from the chaff.
So having seen through the camouflage of rather grandiose, nice-sounding claims and phrases and politics, I have a more penetrating gaze when people say, well, sign this bill or don't do this or that.
But some people are disappointed with the Brown of today. Sierra Club director Catherine Phillips first met Brown as a young reporter decades ago. She says the governor spends less time now challenging the status quo and more time cultivating big business.
I wish he listened more. I wish he was a little bit more in touch with the public and Californians and what they think about the environment and less beholden to some of the special interests.
By most accounts, Brown is a more focused governor this time around. Sacramento lawyer Gene Livingston held two top posts in Brown's first administration. He says back then, the governor tried to address lots of different issues at once. Now, he picks a few priorities and sticks to them.
And rather than delegate and depend on other people in his administration to implement that, he is staying very much involved personally.
Brown says a $27 billion deficit has a way of grabbing one's attention.
So I would say, by the nature of things, the problems are greater, they're more specific, and therefore I find it much easier to array priorities than when I was governor the last time.
Jerry Brown has long shown the ability to surprise, evolve, and even exasperate. That seems to suit many Californians. Polls and fundraising totals suggest he's a heavy favorite to win a record fourth term next year. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Misty watercolor memories of the way we were.
And that song topped the charts back in Governor Brown's first term in 1974. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about the latest animal control controversy in the Valley. Last year, it was the city of Fresno, the county of Fresno, and the Central California SPCA that had a falling out. This year, it's the county of Kern and the city of Bakersfield. We'll talk to representatives of the county and learn how they're trying to find new homes for 700 animals within 40 days. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition here on Valley Public Radio. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last week, the conflict that's been brewing for months between the city of Bakersfield and Kern County over the city-owned animal control facility that the county has been renting for years finally boiled over. On Wednesday, the city told the county it has 40 days to get out. This after negotiations for a 2-year extension of the current arrangement fell apart. The dispute, of course, goes back to money and just who was shouldering more of the bill for the region's pet overpopulation problem. Joining us now to tell us more about this situation is Kern County Animal Control Director Jen Woodard and County Administrative Officer John Nyland. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Jen, I want to start with you. This eviction notice from the city shelter has to be a big logistical challenge. You have around 700 animals in your care. Where are you at in terms of moving forward?
Well, we're exploring all the options that are out there. We've really asked the community and sort of outside our community for assistance, and we've had a tremendous response from just volunteers, people wanting to help, from animal welfare groups, rescues and shelters, to even disaster groups that are interested in helping us. And so we're really considering all the options. We do plan to be out in the time period, and one of the options we're considering is getting a portable kennel-style set up for the animals to be able to just move them to on October 1st.
What is the cost of this going to be for the county moving forward? In general terms, this has to be a challenge not only logistically, but in terms of bringing this new operation online. That doesn't sound like a cheap thing to do.
You're right. It isn't cheap. You know, we're going to have to allocate resources for all of this activity, the movement, the actual rental of the kennels, then purchase of kennels, probably the acquisition of property. It's going to cost a lot of money. But at this point in time, our single most important focus is the animals. We're here to provide safe care for these animals. And while it will cost us money, and certainly more money than we had originally anticipated, it's something we just must do.
Now, you had been working on this plan with the city for some time now. This is an issue that's been brewing for well over a year. How would you characterize your relationship with the city and City Manager Alan Tandy right now?
I work with Mr. Tandy quite a bit on a variety of subjects, and I have respect for him. I think he's one of our better city managers. At this point, I feel, though, that it was unfortunate that the city manager and the city manager's office didn't let us know that the agreement that was struck between he and our members of the Board of Supervisors just 3 weeks ago wasn't going to work. And instead of letting us know by phone call or text or email, we get a letter from the city attorney a week after the decision was made, giving us 40 days. So it's unfortunate that that's how the city chose to operate in this event.
This is an issue that certainly is big in Kern County, but throughout the state, many communities are dealing with animal control. The San Joaquin Valley is an area that has a large pet overpopulation problem. You have a lot of rescue groups that are very active and very vocal in pushing for no-kill shelters, no-kill alternatives. And I'll direct this to, I guess, both of you. Do you think that is a realistic option given the amount of pet overpopulation we have here in the valley and in Kern County?
Well, Joe, absolutely. I think it's possible. I mean, 20 years ago, people thought, oh, no kill, that's never going to happen. And here we are with many communities, cities and counties that are no kill, and they're being used as models. Yes, it's true that, you know, Kern County does have a problem right now, and that's one of the things that we're trying to solve. And in some ways, this might actually set us up to succeed in that we'll be building relationships with different groups, national organizations, rescue organizations that hopefully will continue as we move into our new facility or portable facility. I think that this type of relationship we're going to build is going to be great. And also, you can always take steps towards no kill. Even if you never get there, the journey there means you're saving more lives. So we're going to continue down that path of putting creative programming in place so that we can save more animals and, of course, try to decrease the intake of them coming in. So I absolutely think it's possible. I do think Kern County will be no kill. It may not be tomorrow or next year, but we're definitely heading down that road.
What's the long-term solution here? This portable shelter situation, is that the long-term answer, or is there a grander vision for the county's role in animal control at this point moving forward?
There certainly is a grander vision. This is a stopgap measure put in place solely for the purpose of meeting the eviction notice that the city gave to the county. We have employed an architect, and we have thoughts and plans for an animal control shelter, an animal services shelter that will be really one of the top-notch no-kill service centers in the Central Valley or the state of California. And as Jen was mentioning, just the philosophy, just the mindset that we're going to be a no-kill shelter opens the door to so many more possibilities, because we're now under pressure to do just that.
Are there any discussions ongoing with the city at this point? Obviously, you have this other lawsuit over tax issues that's going on, the split between the city and the county. But are there any continuing discussions? Is there maybe a way to avert this eviction in the 40 days?
You know, Joe, we're always open to talking with the city. We have reached out to them in a variety of settings. We have brought compromise proposals. We have done everything we think we can, and we're certainly welcome to hear if there are other options out there, but we're always open to listening to the city and negotiating. And if that happens, that's great, but right now we're planning for the city to hold firm in its position that we have to be out of that shelter in 35 days.
One last question for Jen. If folks are interested in helping in some way or getting involved, what can they do? What would you suggest they do? How can they reach you?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of people reaching out to us, and we so appreciate it. And if anybody wants to offer assistance as a volunteer, or we're looking for foster homes for short-term fostering, or if people want to help us connect with rescue organizations or shelters in their area, even outside of Kern County, please call us at our main number, which is 661-321-3000, and they can direct to myself, Jen Woodard, or our Deputy Director, Cheyenne Scholl. We're collecting all the information and all the people that are interested, and we'll be reaching out fairly shortly about what that looks like. They can also reach us via email. We have our website. We also have a Facebook page, Kern County Animal Control. We also have Twitter, so there's a number of different ways that people can reach us, or they can just come in person to one of our three shelters.
We've been talking with Kern County Animal Control Director Jen Woodard and County Administrative Officer John Nyland about the City of Bakersfield's decision to evict the County of Kern from the city's animal control facility. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Last Wednesday was also a big day in the small Fresno County community of Selma. The city opened its brand new art center with a ribbon cutting and an open house. And while the building's striking architecture has generated a lot of interest and comments from residents, it's the building's mission as a cultural center that has truly captured the community's imagination. So as a curious reporter, I went to Selma to see the building and to find out what the buzz is all about. Dozens of painters, plasterers, and electricians were hard at work last week in downtown Selma, putting the finishing touches on a new jewel in the city's center, the $2.5 million Selma Art Center.
As soon as the open house is over the following day, we've got to keep working to finish up the rest of the work. We're about 10 days from being complete on the project.
That's Selma Mayor Ken Gray. But while some of the last details still need to be installed inside the 264-seat theater, the building, which was designed by the world-renowned architect Arthur Dyson and his firm DSJ, is already creating a community buzz.
Sometimes in our other public buildings, we have a tendency to standardize those a bit. And here we basically gave him an open palette, and boy, he really went for it.
There's no doubt the building is a bold visual statement. Just ask Randy McFarland, vice chairman of the Selma Arts Council and a member of the Raisin Cane Players, a community theater group that will call the building home starting next month.
As you can see here in downtown Selma, architecture tends to be old-fashioned, very traditional, very conservative, and yet the architectural team headed by Art Dyson designed the front of this building, which is anything but conventional, anything but conservative. But it just absolutely says Arts with a capital A. And that was the intent.
Situated on the west side of High Street, right in the middle of Selma's historic turn-of-the-last-century downtown, sits the theater. Its facade bursts out onto the sidewalk like a sculpture. Two huge plaster-covered diamonds mark the entry, and giant beams jut out to form a canopy, not unlike the wings on a fighter jet. Here's architect Arthur Dyson.
You know, this was really exciting, especially from a small community like that.
He says the site, hemmed in on two sides by other downtown buildings, provided the inspiration to do something different.
A lot of folks see obstacles, but sometimes they're opportunities in disguise. And you have a great urban setting. You've got a nice fabric of buildings that are very pleasant because they're very honest. They're an expression of the time that they were done.
Dyson says that instead of trying to replicate that century-old look, he wanted to do something authentic to this era.
We tried to do something very clean, very honest, very simple. The buildings have these two geoforms in the front of it that really are screens. They're going to be a backdrop, and so there will be colored lights that will be projected on those. And so different times of the year, you'll see different things. On the 4th of July, it might have stars and stripes on it.
The look is cutting edge, but it's what will go on inside that really has people excited.
As you walk through this little hallway where we are now with the low ceiling, and then you turn the corner, and all of a sudden it opens up into this great hall where the audience will sit. and a huge stage which is actually deeper, including the work area, than the audience itself.
State-of-the-art sound and LED lights have McFarlane's group eager to launch their first production in the new space, The Sound of Music, which will open on September 14th. Dennis Adkins, director of the Raisin Cane Players, says it's also a relaunch for the company itself, which has been silent for a couple of years in search of a new home.
If you look at the first facility that we housed, it was in the Pioneer Village in an old wood frame structure called the Unger Opera House. You look at that and you see the peeling paint and the boards falling away, and you look up and you see sky in the roof. That's kind of where we started, and to evolve from there to this beautiful modern theater as a gem of the valley and the community as well is certainly something that thrills not only myself but all those that involved.
So how did the city of Selma come to open a first-rate arts center in an era when so many other cities are simply struggling to survive? Years ago, the city bought an old downtown furniture store to turn into an arts center. But before anything could happen, the roof collapsed and the building was a total loss. And another city-owned building, which had been used by the theater group, was sold to the local hospital, which needed to expand. The money from the sale, plus that from the insurance company and donations, was just enough to construct the new building, which Selma Mayor Ken Gray is happy to note is completely paid for.
It's a real investment for today and into the future for the generations to come in Selma to give them an opportunity to express themselves. Selma is a community born out of the agricultural industry, but we have youth that's coming to life here, generations that are moving on, they're moving out of the agricultural field and into other walks of life. And as that's happening, I think Selma's growing in a way to accommodate that shift in its culture. And I think this is a really progressive way of doing that.
In addition to the Raisin Cane Players, the center will also host a variety of events, including a Latino art series on the first Friday of every month beginning in November, as well as student groups and other arts organizations. Nicolette Anderson, the Arts Center coordinator, is also responsible for the youth programs which the city runs.
I think that it's showing the community hope. I think it's showing them progress. I know that this building is going to bring downtown up a notch. It's going to help the businesses here. It's going to help the restaurants that are nearby.
And according to Mayor Gray, the 12,000 square foot Arts Center is already having an impact. Local businesses on High Street have already completed renovations of their own storefronts, and more are on the way. And as far as the building's striking modern facade, he says it's already done its job.
If we get people to talk about art, then we've captured our job. I think that's what this building speaks to, is if people love it, great. If they're adamant that they don't think they like it, they're still going to talk about it. And that still means they're talking about art. So we're very pleased with that. Not everybody likes every painting. Not everybody likes every sculpture. But they will discuss it.
And he hopes the new building and the programs inside will help enhance the quality of life for residents in the Raisin Capital of the World.
Basically, what the Art Center says about Selma is that the people here understand the value of all the arts in their variety of forms toward the lifestyle that we would all like to live.
The curtain will rise for the first time on September 14th. Reporting from downtown Selma, I'm Joe Moore for Valley Public Radio. And stay with us. In just a moment, we'll be back on Valley Edition with more of our program. We'll talk about the crisis in healthcare in the Fresno County Jail and more. We'll learn about B. Franco as well. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. In May, a federal judge ordered the state of California to reduce its prison population by 9,600 inmates by the end of the year to reduce an overcrowding problem that advocates say endangers the health of inmates. It's just the latest ruling in a legal battle that's been going on for years over the state's ability to provide adequate health care services to the prison population. But here, closer to home, there's another health care problem for those behind bars: adequate mental health care. In Fresno County, about one in every six inmates require antipsychotic drugs, but the county cut back on providing medication and other services years ago. The results have been sobering. The situation has prompted a multi-part watchdog report from the Fresno Bee called Locked in Terror, which outlines just how the problem developed. And joining us now in our studio, we have the two reporters behind that project, Mark Benjamin and Barbara Anderson from the Fresno Bee. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Exactly how did this problem first start years ago? Because the county, going back over a decade ago, had a very good record in providing mental health services in the jail, but things changed dramatically over the years.
In 2006, the county made a change in how they were handling mental health services in the jail. Prior to that time, the behavioral health department for the county provided those services. But that department started having major budget problems, had like a $16 million deficit. So the decision was made to transfer those mental health services to the public health department, the county public health department, which was providing and still does provide the medical services for the jail. And they decided that combining the services under mental health services and medical services under the public health department sounded like it would make for a more efficient use of money. Unfortunately, within 2 years, that was not the case, and they were cutting the nurse night shift at the jail that provided services for the mental health services at the jail. And things began to just deteriorate from there. They started restricting the types of drugs that were being used to save money, and things just de-escalated from there.
And what were the results, Mark?
The results were many inmates were not getting the medications they needed, and many of these people were brought into the jail for various crimes, never even getting through the system, never even getting into the court system to be found guilty. So before their cases are even adjudicated, they're going into the jail, they're not getting their proper medications, and then they are losing their capability to understand what's going on around them in the courtroom. So when they go to court, their lawyer says, "My guy isn't able to understand what's going on around him. I would like to have a psychiatric evaluator come in and take a look at him." More often than not, those psychiatric evaluators find that these people are not able to stand trial. They do not understand what they are facing, and they are usually shipped off to a state mental hospital, which would mean Atascadero or any of the other three in Los Angeles, Napa, and Riverside area.
This has been a big concern by many. This actually prompted a lawsuit in 2011. Tell us about that.
The lawsuit alleged that not only were inmates not getting their proper psychotropic medications, they were also not being – they weren't even getting medical care, proper medical care. So the lawsuit said that lawsuit essentially demanded that these people get their medical care. And right now the county is somewhat relented and agreed to some extent to have a fact-finding group come in and take a look at what's going on in the jail. This group has nearly finished its investigation, and probably by the end of the year we'll learn more about how it went and what they found and what type of direction they want the county to take.
We'll talk about some of the consequences and things in a moment, but I want to make this a personal story because I know that through your reporting you've looked at the lives of a number of different inmates who have been in the system and faced these challenges and the lack of adequate mental health care and what it meant to them, their families, and their situations with the law. Barbara, I know that you worked on reporting this story about Travis Finley, who was a central character. Tell us about him and what happened in his case.
A very tragic kind of case. He's a young man that has had mental illness for years, according to his family. As a teenager, he was diagnosed, they say, with schizophrenia. And he's been in and out of the jail for several different crimes over the years. The family would say when he was in jail, he did not receive the medications that he'd been prescribed on the outside by the private doctors who had were able to get him stable. He had become fairly stable on the drugs that they had prescribed for him. But in 2012, toward the end of the year, he was in the jail for several, I think, Mark can correct me, but I think for several different time periods. But one time for at least 4 months straight, he was in the jail, and the family says he did not receive any of his medications that he needed. And he basically lost his grip on reality, it appears. At least that's what his family believes happened. And when he was released, he went to his grandmother's house. He had a very close relationship with her, although he had been physically abusive to her at the same time. He went to her home. They allowed him to stay in the garage, his aunt did, because she was concerned about him being alone with the grandmother. The family, he's accused now of killing his grandmother. His family really believes that if he'd been able to stay on his medication, that possibly that tragedy would not have occurred.
Did anyone see this coming? Obviously, this is about money, and the county facing budget difficulties was trying to save a little here, save a little there. Were there warning signs early on that could have prevented some of these things, and were there people throwing red flags, or was this just a surprise to everyone in the county?
Well, we first started reporting this story back in 2009, and not Barbara or I, it was Pablo Lopez who started doing it. So it was pretty obvious that something was going on back then. At that point, he had interviewed family members of Scott Kinney, the lawyer, defense lawyer, and his family members had taken medication to the jail and were turned away. They said that he needed these types of things. He needed his medication, lithium, I believe in this case, to stay stable. And he was decompensating and losing control and being placed in isolation. And I think it was something that they saw coming. But they would also deny that it was about money. They would say that it was about two types of drugs specifically, Wellbutrin and Seroquel, which could be abused by inmates. And those drugs cost a lot. Those drugs by themselves cost a lot of money, and a lot of the inmates were requesting it. So they cut those out of the formulary, thereby saving lots of money. And in a report, or actually a presentation that the two heads of the jail psychiatric services made to a conference in Monterey, it was portrayed as a money saver, or at least other folks picked it up as a money saver, while they would deny that. They would deny that back. They would say that it was about trying to keep these guys from abusing a number of people from abusing these drugs.
Throughout this whole debate and throughout the state about those behind bars, whether they're in state prisons or county jails, realignment, all these things, it seems like there's a lot of shifting of responsibilities, of shifting dollars from one account that's facing challenges, as you said, behavioral health when this started, then to the Department of Public Health had more money in that account, and now it's a problem over there. We have inmates in state prisons now going to county jails, shifting a problem from there to there. Yeah, the county was saving money, but it also wound up costing taxpayers money in another way, because while those drugs may cost $9,000 per inmate, it costs a lot more than that to house an inmate in a state psychiatric facility, right?
Right.
Correct.
If you were to take a look at – and I did a high-end look at a drug that is a little bit more expensive than most, Abilify. And I took a high-end price for Abilify, which may be a very high-end price now. Of about $9,000 for a six-month course. And if you looked at what it costs to send somebody to a Tascadero, it would for 6 months, it would be about $108,000 based on a $600 a day cost there. So the state taxpayers pay the $108,000. The county taxpayers would pay the course for Abilify. So there's a distinction there that the county is absolved of paying that cost for the medicine, but the state taxpayers then pick it up once they go to the state hospital. But the costs are 12 times higher to go to the state hospital and to just give them a simple course of drugs here in that case.
The numbers in this story are staggering. Fresno County, you report, has sent nearly 400 inmates since 2007 to state mental hospitals. That's more per capita than any county but Kern. I know that some people might say, well, the inmates we have here are just different. They're the population. Rural areas have more mental illnesses. There was a recent report that came out that said just that. But this is a significant issue that's markedly different here than throughout the rest of the state. Barbara, can you comment on that a little more and just the challenges there?
Well, I think, yes, the concern is that, as Mark found when he was talking with attorneys, is they would send an inmate to Atascadero for treatment. They would be treated there, come back as competent to help in their defense. But then once they were back at the jail, within just a very short period of time, they would decompensate. And
when you say decompensate, what does that mean?
They would be unable again to help with their defense. Their mental stability had deteriorated, and so they would have another hearing, and they would be sent back to the state mental hospital. And it was sort of just this ping-ponging going back and forth. Again, it's very costly. The transportation just to take them to Atascadero, the time that the sheriff's deputies have to spend in the transportation, taking them there, waiting there until they are, put as an admitted as a patient there. All of those kind of costs, too, are very, hard maybe sometimes to put a dollar figure on, but really do add up. So that's one of the concerns that we have here in Fresno.
And it's not just been medications that were cut. At one point, nursing shifts were also eliminated, an overnight shift, right?
Right. The night shift of nurses at the jail was cut, and it was assumed that the sheriff's department could take care of the assessment of the people when they came in. But there's been concern that those assessments have not been as vigorous, I guess, as they were under a nurse, and that someone then could end up spending longer in the jail before they're actually seen by a mental health professional and receive the care that they need to have.
All right. Again, Barbara Anderson and Mark Benjamin from the Fresno Bee. They're the reporters behind a watchdog report called Locked in Terror, documenting the impact of cuts to mental health services in the Fresno County Jail and what that has meant for not only inmates but also the community at large and taxpayers. Thank you both so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Joe. And again, you can find their reporting online at FresnoBee.com. In fact, BeeWatchdog.com/LockedInTerror. Stay tuned. In just a moment on Valley Edition, we'll be back and hear the amazing story of a woman from Selma who passed away last week, who had a brush with literary fame she didn't even know existed for years. We'll hear about the late Bea Franco, or Bea Cozera as she was later known, in just a moment with author Timzy Hernandez. That's coming up on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. One of the most acclaimed works of the latter half of the 20th century was Jack Kerouac's On the Road. It was inspired by a road trip across the country, which included a trip through the Central Valley. One character features prominently in the book from the Valley. She was known as the Mexican Girl. But who inspired that character? Our next guest has a fascinating story to tell us about the late Bea Cozera, or Bea Franco, as she was known back then, and her brush with literary stardom. And Timzy Hernandez joins us today. Tim, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm sorry it has to be in such a sad time. Last week we lost Bea. She was someone who you came to be close with and inspired a new novel, which you have coming out in fact, next week.
Next week, right. Yeah.
Manana Means Heaven. Yeah, you know, back in 2007, after I had read On the Road for probably the third time in my life, which is Kerouac's book, I was standing in Colorado at the time, and this chapter, which is about 19 pages, it jumped out at me, and the chapter was about who he called the Mexican girl, this woman named Terry, right, which is a fictional name, but it was based on his short relationship with a woman named B. Franco, who was a farm worker here in Selma, California, right here in the valley. So, I didn't know that at the time, and in fact, you know, as I said, I read the book before, and I just always kind of viewed her as a fictional character, but in that moment, it dawned on me that, you know, this is probably a real person, and I wanted to know if it was or wasn't. And that's kind of was the question I had in my mind, is who was she for real? You know, in real life, who was she? And that was what prompted my – originally, again, it was just this big fictional idea I had in my mind. I thought, well, it'd be cool if someone wrote a book, sort of a spinoff from her point of view of their time together. And it was just going to be completely fictional anyway. But I started to do some of the research and discovered that her name, you know, she had played a pivotal role, pivotal enough in Kerouac's career, in fact, that her name and her story has been told in over 20 books, 20 biographies about Jack Kerouac. So they always mention her. And so after finding that out, I knew that I had to go look and see if I could find her family still. I didn't think I'd find her alive, but certainly her family.
How did you go about that?
I found out that there were she had letters. She had sent Kerouac letters, and these letters were in the New York Public Library. So I flew to New York and looked at these five letters, and they were addressed to Selma here in California. And she talked about there were certain landmarks and things that you'd see here that I recognized, you know. And so that's kind of what prompted me. I started to look for those addresses and started to kind of do some of the research. And at one point, I finally, after, you know, I even went as far as hiring a private investigator to help me try and find the family, locate the family. All of that was fruitless. And I finally said, I'm going to give up and surrender and just write this fictional account based on what I did know about her and what I did know about the San Joaquin Valley during that time. And that was the idea. And as soon as I surrendered, though, you know, a short time later, I ended up finding out that her family still lived here in Fresno. So,
how did you find that out?
Well, actually, it was my mother. My mother was quite invested in this story by then. She said, "You can't give up looking for the Mexican girl. You can't. Give me your files. Give me everything you have, and I will look for her. I'm retired. I have nothing better going on right now. I will look for her." And so I said, "Okay, go ahead." So I gave my mother the files, and I basically started to write work on this fictional novel. And 24 hours later, my mother phone called me, and she said, "I have two addresses for you that I've discovered, and you might want to go look at them." And so I went in. One of them was in Los Angeles, so I knew I wasn't going to go there right away. But the other one was here in Fresno. And in fact, some of the details were like the age. It would have been the right age of the same woman, B. Franco, that I was looking for, you know, late 80s, early 90s. And anyway, I went in and just did a sort of cold knock on the door. I went in and knocked on the door on her home in East Central Fresno. And I said, "This is who I am," to the family, because she didn't answer the door. It was her daughter at the time, Patricia. And I told them, you know, "I believe your mother is the Mexican girl." And they said, "We don't know who Kerouac is. We never heard the name." And they didn't want to open the door, in fact, at first, because they thought, you know, it was a pretty tough neighborhood. So they were like, "Who are you? What do you want?" And after I explained to them – and actually, it wasn't until I showed them a copy of their mother's letters that they finally did open the door to me and say, "Come on in, let's talk." And then I started to show them all the books and the story and – of names of family members that were mentioned in her letters and things like that, that they started to put the pieces together themselves. Her children, B's children did, Patricia and Albert. And it wasn't until that I had them on board, you know, with the book. And of course, this whole time, this happened, these first few interviews happened without me ever meeting B. I finally thought to ask, you know, is your mother alive? And they said, "Yeah, she is alive and she's asleep right now and she's in the other room." And it was just like, I have to meet her, you know, and I did. They brought her out, and I met her for the first time.
What was that like? What do you remember?
It was incredible.
From that?
It was unexpected because, like I said, I didn't even expect that she would be alive anymore, and she was, and she came out very healthy. And this was in 2010, in October of 2010 or September. And she came out, and she looked exactly very much as Kerouac had described her. You know, very short, petite, light skinned Mexican girl, Latina, but she had blue eyes. In his book, she has blue eyes, but in real life, she has green eyes, you know, so there's these sort of slight variations. But she was pretty much how he described her, you know, and very just very happy to meet me, you know. So
did she remember her romantic connection with literary icon Jack Kerouac?
Well, I think I'm going to leave that question for the readers. That's a big part of the plot, and I really would like for readers to indulge in that. But I will tell you that she had a lot of fond memories and a lot of also difficult memories of that time in 1947 and 48. During the time, you know, she met Kerouac because she was actually fleeing from an abusive relationship with her first husband, and she was basically parting ways, and she ended up at a Greyhound bus station in Selma, and that's where she met Kerouac, yeah.
So let's talk about your novel now, Mañana Means Heaven. Fiction, historical fiction,
yeah.
Biography.
Yeah, it's kind of a hybrid, and I know the publishers had a tough time grappling with some of it also. You know, the book opens up – the bulk of it is historical fiction. But the book opens up with a nonfiction foreword. So I describe about how, you know, my first interview with her and all of that. And then it goes into a sort of fictional world that you get her story, her life story, who she is, told in the same 15 days that she is with Kerouac. So it's I was trying to find – one of the techniques I had to use, I was trying to find a way to really get her voice in there more than, you know, an author telling you. I really wanted her own voice to come through. So I taped our interviews when I interviewed her about her life. And I actually put – there are big sections, monologues in the book that I put her, you know, what she was telling me, parade them down. So that way you get her telling you the story as if she were telling it to Kerouac. And then at the end of the book, you get another about 20 pages of an afterword that also – go over my research and how I found her and all of that. So it's a little bit of both. You know, there's some fiction in there, but there's also a lot of, you know, truth to it. Yeah.
It's very sad the way this worked out, that last week we lost B. Franco at the age of 92.
Yeah.
Your remembrances of her, the woman that you met in 2010.
Sure.
How would you characterize her?
Yeah, you know, she had a sense of humor about her, you know, and she also had a sense of perspective about her life. You know, she knew that she was 92, and she knew, you know, her health was starting to wane already. And actually, in 2010, she was 90 years old when I first met her. And but you know, when I asked her, when I told her about all this information, you know, that her name was mentioned in over 20 books, you know, she wasn't aware of that. She wasn't aware that this Kerouac guy at one point ever became anything, you know.
Just a guy driving through
just
the valley.
Just a guy driving through the valley that she had a relationship with for a short time. And, you know, she was very nonchalant about it. She said, you know, why me? What did I do that's so special to merit any books, you know, that kind of thing. And so she had a real sense of humor, you know. She was still smoking cigarettes at age 90. But, you know, she did like the idea of this book, and she was excited about it. And she lived all the way up until the book. I sent her the book in early August, an actual hard copy of it. And she received it, held it in her hands, looked at it. Her family took photos of her with her book. And then 7 days later, she passed away.
My goodness.
Yeah.
My goodness. The new book, Mañana Means Heaven, by author Tim Z. Hernandez, is published next week. It, I'm sure, will be available at all the normal retail outlets for literary works,
right,
and
right.
Also electronic copies as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's two opportunities for folks to just be a part of it. One of them is at the Fresno Art Museum on October 4th at 6 o'clock, and you can look at their website. We're doing the book release for this event there. So her family will all be there as well, and they're excited about it. But also this Thursday, which is in 2 days from now, at 11 o'clock at the Belmont Memorial Park, her family is holding her services, and they wanted the public to know about it, for folks to come out, any admirers or fans of hers to come out and, you know, offer their condolences there. So that's this Thursday at 11 o'clock, Belmont Memorial Park.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us today, and also thank you for your research in telling this untold story of a valley connections to literary history.
Right. My pleasure.
And a great human story indeed. That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter @kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.